This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the U.S. might step up military activity against ISIS. The announcement yesterday included the possibility of more ground raids and airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. ISIS has emerged as a destabilizing military power in the Middle East. A new book traces the group's beginnings to a series of blunders in the U.S. and Middle East dating back to the 1990s. An amnesty by the Jordanian government and the false assertion by the Bush administration that ISIS founder Abu al-Zarqawi teamed up with Saddam Hussein were critical events in the rise of ISIS. Journalist Joby Warrick took a close look at the origins of ISIS and the threat it now poses. His book is called Black Flags. Joby is an intelligence reporter for The Washington Post and a Goldsboro native who used to report for The News and Observer. Welcome, Joby.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about Zarqawi, his origins. He starts out as essentially a street thug. Tell us where he began.
You cannot imagine a more unlikely person to head a terrorist movement, especially one that involves Islamist radicals. Here's someone who had been uneducated, a guy from the street who had been in gangs, who drank, who had tattoos, and then ended up getting religion, went to Afghanistan to fight in the civil war there, and then came back as a radical Islamic warrior, or at least as he saw himself. And it was this man who had sort of the vision and the idea and kind of created a cell around himself that ultimately became what we now know as ISIS.
And the help in creating that cell was a literal prison cell in a prison built by the British, but in Jordan, where he was surrounded by people who he could radicalize day and night. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Jordanians made a couple of mistakes with the radicals that were coming up in the early 90s. What they did was they thought they were too dangerous to be kept with the rest of the prison population, and so they isolated them in a prison all by themselves. But being housed together, they ended up kind of creating this jihadi university with Zarqawi as the leader, training, you know, creating command structures and discipline, and this is where they first became powerful. But the second mistake the Jordanians made was in 1999, they granted a general amnesty that would allow political prisoners, people who were not accused of particularly violent offenses, to be released. And so you had 2,000 prisoners just sent home, and part of that group was Zarqawi and a number of his followers.
Now, how dangerous was Zarqawi? In other words, what was he arrested for, and how high a profile did he have at the time he was arrested?
In the beginning, these guys were bumblers. They had big visions and ideas, but they weren't very capable of carrying anything out. And so you have them attacking what they saw as symbols of Western corruption, like liquor stores and pornographic theaters, things like that. And there's one story in the book about one of the targets was a pornographic theater in Amman. And so they sent this hapless young man to blow the place up. But he became so engrossed in the movie that he forgot about his bombs. So he sat there literally as the thing went off, and he lost his own legs and no one else was hurt. But this is the kind of sort of, you know, gang that couldn't shoot straight that started out, you know, in 1999 and then became much more threatening later on.
And he does begin to take at least the trappings of religion quite seriously as he becomes radicalized. You said that he, among other things, you know, among other breaches of Islamic law, he had tattoos. Talk about the removal of that tattoo when he decided to take this seriously.
Yeah, this gives you insight into the mentality and the discipline of this man. But, you know, as we talked about, he had been, you know, a thug as a young man. He'd gotten in all kinds of trouble, and he'd gotten tattoos, a symbol of his wild days. And later on, he became very embarrassed about the tattoos. He would wear long sleeves so nobody could see them, and eventually decided that, you know, I have to get rid of them, and he tried various methods. And ultimately, he got one of his relatives to take a razor blade and cut the tattoo off, you know, just surgically remove it from the skin without any anesthesia, just with a kind of a crude operation, and then just sewed the skin back up. And, you know, a doctor who was in the prison, you know, asked him about this, and he just said, "If tattoos are forbidden, of course I had to take it off, and this is how I did it."
So he is taking himself seriously. He's building a following. We're talking about the late 90s now. How big a threat was he in the 90s? You say that the gang that couldn't shoot straight, what was his profile in American intelligence? How are Americans viewing Zarqawi at the moment?
at the time, we didn't really know who he was. It wasn't until about 2000 when he was involved as a bit player in the Millennium Plots. And readers might, or listeners might remember, around the turn of the millennium, there were a couple of terrorist plots to attack, for one, the Los Angeles International Airport. There was another one to attack hotels in Jordan. And Zarqawi was a small player in one of those plots. But he was still pretty much an unknown until years later when the United States made him famous.
Well, I'm going to talk about that and how his rise was really elevated by Colin Powell and the Bush administration. But before we get to that, I want to talk about his links to other terrorist groups. Any connection, or what was his connection with Osama bin Laden, who we were paying very close attention to at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. So Zarqawi thought that he might be part of al-Qaeda. It fit his, the way he saw himself. He thought he could benefit from the alliance. And what's interesting, and as the book recounts, al-Qaeda wasn't interested in him. They thought he was too radical. He was too hard to control. He wasn't very impressive. He didn't speak well. And so when he shows up at bin Laden's doorstep, literally in 2000, and asked to be taken in, bin Laden just kind of pushes him aside and says, look, you can have this camp way out in the western part of the country near the Iranian border. You're not going to join al-Qaeda. We'll give you a little bit of support, but you're not going to be one of us. And so he went off and decided to develop his own movement, and that's what he did, using mostly volunteers and recruits from Jordan, from the Palestinian territory, from Lebanon, and from Syria, the Levant, essentially.
And again, tell us where this is, where he's developing this following.
So this is it's kind of way out near the town of Herat, which is very close to the Iranian border. And Iran ends up being important in Zarqawi's early development because this becomes the thoroughfare for his recruits coming from other parts of the world. The Iranians would look the other way and would allow some of these jihadists to transit the country and join him in western Afghanistan. And toward the, right before the 9/11 attacks, he had a following that conservatively included about maybe 200 people, as well as, a network of associates in other parts of the world, including in Europe.
ISIS is now, of course, infamous for its brutal tactics, its beheadings. Was that did that characterize the group in its earliest days?
Not in the earliest days. In fact, they were torn ideologically about whether things like suicide bombings were permissible, and they would have long arguments about that, because the Quran states very explicitly that a good Muslim doesn't take his own life except in very extreme circumstances. And yet later on, you'll see that Zarqawi and his followers not only embraced the idea of suicide bombings, but advocated as something that's absolutely necessary in fighting, powerful foes like the United States.
All right. So here is this self-proclaimed terrorist leader. He has a cell. It's growing. He doesn't have much influence with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Talk about how he actually comes to great prominence and the U.S. role in that.
Yeah. So there's this interesting moment after the 9/11 attacks when the Bush administration is making plans for the invasion of Iraq. And there's legitimate concern, I think, in the early days that there might be connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. If Saddam Hussein, who we thought had weapons of mass destruction, if he were to collaborate with al-Qaeda in some way, he could become a very, very big threat. And so here's this mysterious figure of Zarqawi who's living by this time in obscurity on the Iraq-Iran border, because after Afghanistan fell, he ended up moving out with his followers and found a refuge in the mountains of Iraq very close to Iran. And so he was physically in Iraq. There were suspicions that maybe he was there because the Iraqis were helping him in some way or tolerating his presence. There were suspicions that maybe he was connected in al-Qaeda in a more significant way. And so in 2003, when Colin Powell went to the United Nations Security Council to make the case for an invasion of Iraq, he talked about Zarqawi as kind of being the poster child, the guy who brought this threat all together. And they even put Zarqawi's picture up on this big screen as this example of this nexus between terrorism and Saddam Hussein and his terrible intelligence apparatus. And it turns out that none of those allegations were true. There was no connection with Saddam Hussein. And yet overnight, Zarqawi becomes a very famous man in the Islamist world.
Well, you talk about the legitimate concern that there might be a possible link, but then the book documents the extent to which Dick Cheney in particular, then vice president, would badger the CIA. And in the course of this book, you profile a number of individuals, one in particular, an analyst named, and I think I've got her name right, is it Neda Bakos?
Bacos, right.
Bacos. And her role in this, and through her eyes, you begin to see the deliberate effort that Cheney and the administration are, the pressure they're putting on the CIA to make up some evidence that there is indeed a connection. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah. In order to justify the invasion, there needed to be a compelling case either for the existence of weapons of mass destruction, and we all know that story very well, or a connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein that would make the Iraqi government a legitimate immediate threat to U.S. and international security. And so Cheney's folks believe very strongly that this link existed, and they were looking around to try to find proof of it. And so you have these long meetings with CIA analysts in which Cheney in person would show up with his dossier and say, we think this is happening. We think there are connections here and there. And the CIA analyst would shake their heads and say, no, that's not true, or we have evidence to the contrary, or that's based on, you know, secondhand hearsay evidence. We don't really think it's true. And eventually, as we know, Cheney sort of won the day, but with a pretty powerful dissent from the CIA officers who knew the evidence the best.
Yeah, and of course that led to the Colin Powell speech that you referenced in your book. You write, with one speech, the White House had transformed Zarqawi from an unknown jihadist to an international celebrity and the toast of the Islamist movement. What did happen to him? I mean, sort of how did that play out? How would we see his celebrity status rise?
It was amazing. I remember covering the story at the time, and we had reporters rushing to Jordan to figure out who this Zarqawi guy was. And there's a story that's or an anecdote related in the book about reporters showing up at the house of his mother and asking about him. And the mother was completely perplexed and said, you know, my son's not that smart. I don't know what you're talking about. But what did happen was that overnight, there were people who were ready to support him, ready to give him money, ready to recruit, to volunteer, to help him. And by the time, you know, the Iraq invasion began in 2003, Zarqawi was physically in Iraq with a pretty impressive network that was growing around him that eventually included members of the Iraqi government, disaffected Ba'athists and, you know, army officers who'd lost their jobs and now were looking for a cause, and he kind of brought them all together.
But again, this is a gang that had not been terribly well organized politically, and the mistakes continued. You talk about the another suicide bombing where one of the – and it was another infamous attack in which one of the bombers, the bomb didn't go off, and the bomber was arrested, in this case a female, and Stanley McChrystal, who's head of the U.S. forces in Iraq, saying that was a big mistake.
Zarqawi, without question, began to overreach a couple years into the Iraq campaign. He was very strategic and very smart, actually, in picking his targets early on. He decided that the best way to take on the American forces was to attack, you know, groups like the Red Cross, United Nations, those that might give the occupation a sense of legitimacy. And so he did that. He blew up the UN headquarters in Baghdad in 2003. He attacked embassies of countries that might have helped us, might have been good partners for the United States. So he isolated us diplomatically, and then he deliberately set about to create a civil war around us by these awful, vicious attacks on Shiite civilians in their mosques and bazaars and in different places to kind of make hostility brew up between Sunnis and Shia. And so in the middle of – by 2004, we're in the middle of essentially a shooting war with Sunnis and Shias killing each other and the United States being caught in the middle. But he did overreach sometimes too, and he tried to attack targets outside the country, and that's when he started to get into trouble.
All right. So talk about then the rise of ISIS and where ISIS is today.
So what happens after Zarqawi is killed, and not to to destroy our plot line here, but Zarqawi is finally taken out in 2006 in a U.S. airstrike. And there's a belief and a hope that his movement would disappear as well. But they didn't. The U.S. managed to sort of drive them underground. They kind of went to ground and weren't very capable for several years in the late 2000s. But then here comes Arab Spring and all this turmoil in countries like Syria and Libya, and a new opportunity develops that the ISIS, or sort of the successor movement to Zarqawi's organization, seizes very effectively and sees an opportunity to grow a bigger army than they had before.
As you say, Zarqawi was killed, and so again, was this because? And it, yet, ISIS survived, and we know what's going on today. We'll talk more about the threat to the future. Is it because he had built a strong organization, or is it because the remnants of that organization, after he was killed, seized an opportunity and rebuilt itself?
Sarkawi had a couple of powerful ideas, and they still animate ISIS to this day. One is that unlike bin Laden and al-Qaeda, who saw this kind of grand vision for eventually toppling Arab regimes and maybe some future day creating a caliphate, Zarqawi wanted to make one right away. He thought that if you just declare it, if you say, here's our caliphate, here's this, we're restoring this, you know, the Muslim world to its rightful place, then it'll happen and people from around the world will come and support you. And that is the model that he pursued in Iraq in the 2000s, and that's exactly what ISIS is doing today. And that makes them different from other terrorist organizations. They want this caliphate to happen. It's their sort of the main organizing principle. And they also embrace this idea of extreme violence, that the more violent you are, the more successful you are. You drive away parts of public opinion. You frighten people in the West, but you inspire your base, the people that you most want to come help you.
I'm talking to Joby Warwick today, the author of Black Flags, today on The State of Things. Black Flags, tell us about that title.
Well, there's a prophetic saying in the Hadith, and the Hadith is a collection of religious writings, spiritual writings. They're not part of the Quran, but are part of a body of religious documents that many Muslims see as sacred. And there's one passage in which the writer talks about these mighty men with long hair and beards, wearing black robes, and coming from the east on their horses and camels, waving black flags. These would be the future Islamic warriors who would come and defend the religion against the infidels. And Zarqawi would read those passages and take them very literally and saw himself as sort of the modern-day equivalent of those ancient Islamic warriors. And so he very deliberately copied those, all that style. They wore black outfits, not like bin Laden with his long robes and beard, but they wanted to appeal to Muslims symbolically by adopting some of these same trappings and props, including the black flags. And you see today ISIS still uses the black flag as part of its symbolism and its ideology.
We talked about the role of the Bush administration in elevating Zarqawi and ISIS to power, but the Obama administration took a misstep. Tell us about that in your view.
There was a moment of time in 2012 when there was a great division within the administration about how to respond to this civil war in Syria that seemed to be going nowhere. There was real hope in the beginning that Assad would simply fall. And I think almost everybody in the region believed it was going to happen. But what happened instead is you get this endless stalemate where rebel armies are taking over territory, controlling parts of the country, but not able to dislodge Assad from power. And within this vacuum, this is where ISIS essentially takes up residence and decide this place where there's no laws, no control, and ISIS can do what it wants to do. There were some in the administration that urged Obama to get involved in a more dramatic way, to help some of the rebel groups, to try to find a way to bring stability to the country so you wouldn't have these dangerous elements take over parts of Syria. And Obama was reluctant to do that. And the book recounts conversations in the Oval Office in which Obama looked at his aides and said, look, can you point to any examples where we intervened in a civil war like this and there was a good outcome? He was talking specifically about Iraq and referring to other interventions as well. And nobody could really answer him. There was no good precedent that anyone could point to is why we should involve ourselves in a serious way. And so at that time, the administration decided to essentially let the conflict play itself out without any major help from the United States to any of the moderate rebel groups.
You've got about 30 seconds left, but how would you characterize the threat of ISIS moving forward?
Well, there are two things. The main thing I think we have to worry about for us is the fact that this message, as horrible and repulsive as it is to us, resonates with a certain part of the population, particularly in the Middle East. But there are people here in the United States who see these videos and they're inspired by them. And so the possibility of lone wolf attacks inspired by ISIS is going to be something we'll be having with us for many years to come, unfortunately.
Joby Warwick, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Washington Post reporter, and author of Black Flags. Joby, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, classical wind quintet Imani Winds returns to Duke University to honor Duke professor and historian John Hope Franklin. Hear them live on The State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.